I'm going to give you a little quiz. I want you to tell me who we're going to be studying tonight. Now, I've tried to arrange these clues in the order of difficulty so that the most difficult is first. So if somebody gets it, you'll know they're pretty smart. We're going to be studying a man whose name, or a man who is called in the Bible, Jedidiah. We're going to be studying a man who openly ordered the murder of his own brother-in-law. We're going to be studying a man whose brother tried to steal his throne. We're going to be studying the life of a man who stated the truth of Romans 3:23 and Isaiah 53:6, 1,000 years before the Apostle Paul. Who is it? Pardon? Close, but no cigar. He was a king. Solomon. Solomon is the man who is also called Jedidiah for a very special reason. Solomon's the man who openly ordered the murder of his own stepbrother, whose brother tried to steal his throne, and who, in his prayer of dedication, quotes the thought or the principle or the truth of what later is recorded in Isaiah 53:6. And Romans 3:23. We're going to begin in 2 Samuel chapter 12. We're going to look at four aspects of the life of Solomon, one of God's special people. And we're going to begin by looking at his royal birth. This will be a very quick look at the birth of Solomon. Who were his parents? David and Bathsheba, that's correct. And you get that from 2 Samuel chapter 12. Which child is he in the birth order?
Second,
that's right. What happened to the first child of David and Bathsheba? That child died as a judgment from God. So to put us in the context of the birth of Solomon, in 2 Samuel chapter 12, you have preceding this the story, the rather sordid story, of King David and Bathsheba. And you know all that took place there, how he took Bathsheba, who was another man's wife, and then consorted to have the man himself killed. And she becomes pregnant as a result, and that's why, of course, he had him killed. But David has the man killed because Bathsheba is pregnant with child, and there is a judgment to be paid, and that is the life of that first child is required of the Lord. Verse 14 of chapter 12, however, because by this deed you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born to you shall surely die. And then goes on, the text says, the seventh day after its birth, the child dies. But we're looking at Solomon, the next born of this couple, David and Bathsheba. Now, we mentioned that Solomon was the second child born to David and Bathsheba, but where does he fit as far as David is concerned? David had other children. What son is he in David's birth order? We don't often pay too much attention to this. He is the eighth son of David. And this would take us back to 2 Samuel chapter 3, just for a quick look, so that if you want, you can make a note. 2 Samuel chapter 3, you have the family line of King David. And the second verse says, sons were born to David at Hebron. And it gives you the first, second, right on through the sixth son. And then when you come over to chapter 12, of course, the seventh son, interestingly enough, is not named. The child born out of that adulterous relationship is not named. That's the seventh son. And the eighth son is the son Solomon. He's a very special child. Go back with me to the 12th chapter and verses 24 and 25 to see that he is sort of picked out or set aside as one of God's special people, if you would, right from his birth. Verse 24 of 2 Samuel 12. Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba and went in to her and lay with her, and she gave birth to a son, and he named him Solomon. Now the Lord loved him. Look at the 25th verse. And sent word through Nathan the prophet, and he named him, what? Jedidiah, for the Lord's sake. So here, and that's basically what Jedidiah means, loved of the Lord, or beloved of the Lord. So there is indication right at his birth that this is a very special child. Now it's interesting because that's the last mention of Solomon until you come to 1 Kings. No more mention. The rest of the book of 2 Samuel is all about the sordid life of David and that family feud, if you would, that goes on through Absalom and all of the troubles that David has with the rest of his sons throughout his life. So turn to 1 Kings and the first chapter. Point number one, we just want to take a quick look at the royal birth of Solomon, born into royalty to King David, his father, and the statement there that he is a very special child. The second thing we want to look at is Solomon as king. And here he has a very troubled beginning. In the first three verses, we find out that he becomes king or is prepared for being the king when his father David is very old. Verse 1 of 1 Kings chapter 1. Now King David was old, advanced in age, and they covered him with clothes, but he could not keep warm. Any of you ever get that way? Just can't put enough on to keep warm. Now, when you get down to the fourth verse, or the fifth verse rather, there is an attempted coup of David's throne, and it's right within the family. And here's where we meet some of the other family members, right within the royal family. Verse 5, now Adonijah, the son of Haggith. Adonijah is the fourth of David's sons that we just looked at in 2 Samuel 3. Adonijah, the son of Haggith was the mother, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. So he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen with 50 men to run before him. And you'll notice as you go on in the verses there, in the first chapter, there is a coronation party prepared. And what is interesting about the guest list is not who was invited, but who was not invited to this coup coronation, so to speak. Look at the 10th verse. But he did not invite Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the mighty men, and Solomon his brother. Very select list of those who were not included in this coup coronation party. Well, you go down beginning at the 11th verse, Nathan and Bathsheba are aware of what's going on, and they make this known to David, the king, who is very old and apparently very feeble and barely able to keep up for himself. And you have a description here in verses 11 through 28 of their getting together with King David and saying, this is what's taking place. Your son, Adonijah, is trying to take over your throne. But if we recall correctly, you have stated that Solomon is the heir to your throne. And that, of course, is the question that she raises, that Bathsheba raises to the king. She says in verse 17, my lord, you swore to your maidservant by the Lord your God, saying, surely your son Solomon shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne. Now you get down to verse 30 for his response. All that has gone on is described there. Verse 30, surely, David says, as I vowed to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, saying, your son Solomon shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne in my place. I will indeed do so this day. And so in verses 38 and 39, if you follow in that first chapter of 1 Kings, you have the coronation that counts, if you would. And a description of that's there. The priest is called Zadok. So Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, the Cherethites and the Pelethites went down and had Solomon ride on King David's mule and brought him to Gion. Zadok the priest then took the horn of oil from the tent and anointed Solomon. Then they blew the trumpet, and all the people said, long live King Solomon. Very interesting to see what follows in those verses. You have Adonijah, who is attempting the coup, partying with his friends. And they hear the noise, verse 39 or 40. And Adonijah comes. Somebody comes in, he says, oh, I see you bring good news. And verse 43, no, not really. And the truth is made known. Our Lord King David has made Solomon the king. And of course, his people are scared to death because of what has taken place. And there's a great flight. And all of a sudden, Adonijah no longer has the support that he needs. And his kingdom is short-lived and falls apart and crumbles right in front of him. And he goes off crawling, just afraid for his life. Look at the second chapter now in the 10th through the 12th verses as we go on developing this point of his coming to the throne. This is where David dies now, and of course he will be the official replacement for his father. Verse 10 of chapter 2, David slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. And the days that David reigned over Israel were 40 years. 7 years he reigned in Hebron, and 33 years he reigned in Jerusalem. One of the interesting things you learn in studying Old Testament history is that although we talk about a united kingdom period where you have all of Israel being ruled by first Saul and then David and then Solomon, which, as we will see, is followed by what we describe as the divided kingdom period, where you have Israel formed by 10 tribes and Judah formed by the other two tribes. We call that a divided kingdom, each with its own king. Although there is that distinct period, what you see, and this is an indicator of it, is that long before that takes place, and that split or that division is recorded right here in 1 Kings chapter 12. It begins in chapter 12. The split is initiated, so to speak, in the 11th chapter, as we're going to see. But from chapter 12 on, you have a divided kingdom or two separate kingdoms. But long before that takes place, during David's reign, you literally have a divided kingdom. Because as you recall from your own reading, David is reigning for a while as king in Hebron. And there is an undermining of that united kingdom, if you would, long before Solomon comes on the scene. And that's why it's mentioned here when we have this record of his life. 7 years he reigned in Hebron as the king, but 33 years in Jerusalem when he finally united the kingdom under one king from the capital city of Jerusalem. All right, so we have David's death recorded there, and Solomon, verse 12, sat on the throne of David his father, and his kingdom was firmly established. Beginning at verse 13 of the second chapter, you have a record of Adonijah's death, Solomon's stepbrother. And this is, I guess, one of those things that you find very difficult to understand. His request, you remember, Adonijah is the stepbrother who wanted to take over for his father David, tried to usurp the throne in an attempted coup. And after he goes in to Bathsheba and says, I want you to go to Solomon, my stepbrother, and the request is this, very simple request. I would like the hand of my father's nurse in marriage. You remember, she's mentioned right here in the first chapter and the third verse. They searched and found a beautiful girl. Her name was Abishag the Shunammite. She becomes David's nurse in his dying days. Well, apparently Adonijah fell in love with her and wants to marry her. And just that request cost him his life. Verse 23 of chapter 2. King Solomon was in a rage, apparently. Swore by the Lord, saying, "May God do so to me and more. Also, if Adonijah has not spoken this word against his own life." And this is where he literally orders the murder of his own stepbrother. For that simple request, perhaps that was the straw that broke the camel's back, if you would, in terms of what he had already been through with Adonijah. But Solomon, at this point, orders the death or the murder of his stepbrother Adonijah. Look over at the third chapter in the first verse, where a statement is made that becomes fundamental to Solomon's downfall. And it's interesting, it's just a statement here. And it begins to unfold when you get back into the later chapters, chapters 9, 10, and 11. But notice the statement in the first verse of chapter 3. Then Solomon formed a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. That's step number one in the downfall of this man. And later on, you're going to see that if we could stop right there, we might have a fine story. Look also at the second and third verses of the third chapter. The people were still sacrificing on the high places. You remember that was anathema to God. There was one place of worship, and where was that? Jerusalem. And here is a simple statement, but I want you to see how it fits into the puzzle as we go on back in the developing chapters of Solomon's life. Here's the statement. The people were still sacrificing on the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. Now, in verses 5 through 14, God is dealing with Solomon directly through a dream. And this is something, this is one of those passages that has a very familiar story. In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said, "Ask what you wish me to give you." Then Solomon said, "Thou hast shown great loving kindness to thy servant David, my father, according as he walked before thee in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart toward thee. And thou hast reserved for him thy great loving kindness, that thou hast given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. And now, O Lord my God, thou hast made thy servant king in place of my father David, and yet I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And thy servant is in the midst of thy people, which thou hast chosen, a great people, which cannot be numbered or counted for multitude. So give thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of thine?" And it was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And you can go on and see the description of how God blesses Solomon because of this wonderful thing that he's asked. Not to be rich, but to be wise. To be discerning. Acknowledging before God that the task before him, the multitudes of people that he is going to be ruling over, are beyond his capability. And truly before God, I believe he is acknowledging his need of God's help, God's sustenance, the wisdom of God, and he asks for discernment. Look at verses 15 through 28, where the dream is quickly confirmed. Now, here's another story that we're familiar with, where these two women come with one child. And both are claiming to be the mother. And you know the story of how Solomon makes a decision that really demonstrates his wisdom. And look at the 28th verse of that third chapter. When all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had handed down, they feared the king. Meaning, I believe, they revered him. For they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. Boy, what a difficult decision. How do you decide whose baby this is? And here you have that story and the wisdom that he asked of God, the discerning spirit that he had asked, is demonstrated moments, apparently, after he had prayed that prayer and God had answered it in that way. Look also at the fourth chapter and verses 29 and 30, where a similar statement is made, confirming that God had answered his prayer. Now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind, like the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men. What a statement. What a confirmation of God answering his prayer. Well, that's his troubled beginning. It wasn't easy with one of your own brothers trying to usurp the throne and pull off a coup. And all the things that he went through just in these opening chapters of his reign. We get to chapter 4, 1 Kings 4 through 10, and we find a different man. Solomon's a builder. He has matured a little, and he is taking on some of the tasks that need his attention. And he launches into a very, very aggressive building program. At this particular point, his throne is secure. The land is at peace. We don't read of any wars that are taking place. And he begins work on the greatest building project of his life, the construction of the temple, which who wanted to build? David, his father. That was the deep desire of David's heart. But it was God's desire, God's plan, that Solomon would build that temple. And so here he is, ready to construct the dwelling place of God. Look at the sixth chapter now, and the first verse and the seventh verse. The sixth chapter, verse 1. Now it came about, in the 480th year after the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. Verse 7. And the house, while it was being built, was built of stone prepared at the quarry, and there was neither hammer nor axe nor any iron tool heard in the house while it was being built. Look down at the 38th verse of that same chapter. In the 11th year, remember, he started in the fourth year. In the 11th year, in the month of Bull, which is the eighth month, the house was finished throughout all its parts and according to all its plans. So he was 7 years in building it, that is, in building the house of the Lord. Now you move to chapter 7. Now we're looking at the building projects. We're looking at Solomon the builder. First, the house of the Lord, 7 years. When you look at the seventh chapter, you have a description of his building, his own house, and other projects. And it is absolutely incredible as you look at it. Verse 1 tells most of the story. Solomon was building his own house 13 years, and he finished all his house. But there were some other things involved as you look at that seventh chapter. Some people have taken issue with how long he took to build God's house as opposed to how long he took to build his own, almost 2-1. Maybe there's an issue there, maybe not. But look at the other things that he was involved in. building the Hall of the Cedars of Lebanon. During this time, he builds a wall around the palace, and he builds the palace for his Egyptian queen. That's in chapter 7, verse 8. The last part of the verse, he also made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom Solomon had married. At the same time, he built stables, he fortifies the outposts of the nation, and he spends money left and right on all sorts of projects. We believe that history confirms that Solomon, while he was ruling as king of Israel, controlled more land, more territory than any king before him, or more land than any king or ruler after him to this day. He had more territory under his control, under Israel's control, than any ruler before or after him. Someone has put a pencil to the cost of his building projects, and these are absolutely staggering figures. It has been estimated that his building projects in his day totaled $4.4 billion. If you can believe that. $4.4 billion in his day. And you have some of the description here in chapter 7. And in other chapters, you have descriptions of the stables that he built. Stables for 4,000 horses. Housing for 1,500 chariots. Absolutely staggering figures. Look at the 8th chapter and the 46th verse while we're here. Chapter 8 and verse 46. This is where Solomon now is addressing the people. And we have a prayer of dedication for the new temple that has just been completed. Look what he says in that 46th verse. Does that look familiar? When they sin against thee, he's talking to the Lord here, for there is no man who does not sin. What does that sound like? Does that sound like Romans 3:23? For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. For there is no man who does not sin. Does that sound like Isaiah 53:6? All we like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. Solomon said it 1,000 years before the Apostle Paul. Look at chapter 9. We had in the opening chapters of 1 Kings an appearance of the Lord to Solomon where he said, "What would you like?" Can you imagine being in that position? God saying to you in a dream, coming to you personally, "Name it and it's yours." Well, he comes not once, but twice. And in the 9th chapter, you have a second appearance of the Lord to Solomon, and this one results in a covenant promise. And notice that it is a conditional covenant. Chapter 9 and verses 1 to 9. It came about when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord, the king's house, and all that Solomon desired to do, that the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time as he appeared to him at Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, "I have heard your prayer and your supplication which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built by putting my name there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. And as for you," here I want you to notice that the covenant that God is making is conditional in some parts. "If you will walk before me as your father David walked," boy, what a testimony, "in integrity of heart and uprightness, doing all that I have commanded you, and will keep my statutes and my ordinances, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, just as I promised to your father David, saying, 'You shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel.' But," verse 6, "if you or your sons shall indeed turn away from following me, and shall not keep my commandments and my statutes which I have set before you, and shall go and serve other gods and worship them." It's interesting that he puts all that in there, as we're going to see in two chapters from now. "Then," verse 7, "I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, and the house which I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. So Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And this house, and he's talking about his own house, the place of worship, the residence of Almighty God. This house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone who passes by will be astonished and will hiss and say, "Why has the Lord done this to this land and to this house?" And they will say, "Because they forsook the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt, and adopted other gods, and worshiped them, and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this adversity on them." Could the Lord have made it any more clear to Solomon? "Here's what I'm going to do for you. Here is my promise, my covenant." This is a personal talk between the Lord and Solomon. And God makes it very clear what he's going to do. Well, jump over with me to the 10th chapter and verse 14. Just keep in mind what was in that covenant. Chapter 10 and verse 14, we have a statement of Solomon's wealth or his income and what he did with it, how he spent it. Look at the 14th verse of chapter 10. "Now the weight of gold which came in to Solomon in 1 year, 666 talents." From what we know of the value of a talent, that comes out to more than $26.6 million a year. A talent was figured at $40,000. And he took in 666 of them a year, or almost $27 million per year just in gold. Beside, notice that little word that begins the next verse. Beside that, from the traders and the wares of the merchants and all the kings of the Arabs and governors of the country. And King Solomon made, and he didn't know what to do with it, so he's making shields out of the gold. He's got so much. Verse 21 tells us again how he spent it. "And all King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None was of silver." It wasn't considered valuable in the days of Solomon. The Hunt brothers were there. That's probably why they bought it all up. Well, notice its effect. The effect of all this wealth, 23 and 24. "So King Solomon became greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. And all the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart." So here he is as a builder. He has amassed the greatest empire that Israel has ever known in all of their days. And he is the man. He's at the top of the heap. The fourth point we want to make is that we're going to look now in the next chapter at a man with a troubled heart. Solomon, man with a troubled heart. As you look at his life in total, and you can go back now with hindsight and see all that has developed in his life, he apparently is so busy building all of these projects, and that was his thing. That's what forced the borders of the empire out. Because, of course, in those days, the wealthier you became, the more powerful you were considered. And so he becomes a very wealthy man and a very powerful man. But apparently during all of these building projects, he finds very little time for the Lord. And throughout his life, he apparently had ignored God's command against intermarrying pagan women. He had ignored God's command against amassing wealth and misusing it, as we're going to see in just a moment. And all of this leads to introducing idol worship, false gods, false worship systems, and he's going to end up losing his kingdom. Look at the 11th chapter, where the sad tale begins to unfold. If we could have stopped with chapter 6 or the prayer of dedication in chapter 8, we'd have a great life story. But you can't do that. You've got to go on and look at the 11th chapter. I want you to look at the first step. We're going to look at three steps of the downward spiral. And these are very graphic verses. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, "You shall not associate with them, neither shall they associate with you." Why? "For they will surely turn your heart away after their gods." Very simple statement. Solomon held fast to these in love. Can you imagine? Now, we have just read how God blessed him. We have just seen where at one point in his life, his main concern was having godly wisdom, being able to make godly decisions, a man recognizing that God was going to use him, but he needed God's help and wisdom in order to carry out. Maybe there's a lesson here on getting so caught up in projects that we forget the source of the strength to complete the projects. Well, the second step involves apostasy. Verse 3. "And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. For it came about when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord, as the heart of David his father had been." Here's a man with a divided heart. Half of a heart for God, so to speak. "For Solomon went after the Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. And Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not follow the Lord fully, as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, on the mountain which is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the detestable idol of the sons of Ammon. Thus he did for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods." Boy, the picture looked real good up to this point. Here he is involved in things that were obviously from the beginning for the glory of God, building a house for God, building the kingdom, if you would, whether right or wrong, in the amount of time that he spent on his own house and all the other projects. But apparently at one point on the right track. But somewhere along the line, he gets his eyes off in the other direction. Begins to make compromises. Begins to maybe see that he's God's man and can do no wrong, if you know what I mean. I think it's kind of easy when you see God blessing something you're doing to begin making compromise. And to see if God is blessing this, well, maybe we can just slide a little over here and boy, God continues to bless, and so, well, we'll maybe slide a little over here. And next thing you know, you're being described in this way. "He did not fully follow the Lord, as David his father had done." His success led, I guess you could say, to pride, causing him to take his eyes off the Lord. And look at the result in verses 9 through 11. "Now the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing, Remember what we read in chapter 10? The Lord made it very plain. The Lord had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods, but he did not observe what the Lord had commanded. So the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and you have not kept my commandment, my covenant, and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant. We've not met him yet. He's coming. But look at the condition. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days. Why? For the sake of your father David. What a testimony David has. But I will tear it out of the hand of your son. That's the condition. Now look at the development of God's judgment. Look at the 26th verse of chapter 11. Here's where we meet the servant. His name is Jeroboam. He worked for Solomon. Very smart man. In our day, he would probably have an engineering degree of some kind. He was over the forced labor and the building projects. He was the key man in all of Solomon's building projects. Now, the man Jeroboam was a valiant warrior. And when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he appointed him over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. Verse 28. I was going to begin with verse 26 where he's introduced, but 28 through 31. And it came about at that time when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem that the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite found him on the road. Now Ahijah had clothed himself with a new cloak, and both of them were alone in the field. Then Ahijah took hold of the new cloak which was on him and tore it into 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, take for yourself 10 pieces. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and give you 10 tribes. Now, what would you do with that kind of information? You've just been told that you're going to possess part of a divided kingdom that your boss is responsible for, the man you serve. But, of course, that's what God said would happen in verse 11. Look at verse 40. Things develop to the point that now Solomon is paranoid. Something's going on. Solomon sought therefore to put Jeroboam to death. But Jeroboam arose and fled to Egypt, to Shishak, king of Egypt. And he was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. Verse 42 through 43. Thus the time that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years. And Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of his father David, and his son Rehoboam reigned in his place. The scenario goes something like this. When Solomon, a man with a divided heart, dies, he leaves a divided kingdom. What we find out from studying other passages and putting it all together is that Solomon built this tremendous empire, not alone on the gifts of foreign dignitaries, like the Queen of Sheba, who is listed here as bringing in many, many millions of dollars in gold herself as a gift, but rather on the backs of his own people. And the burden of taxation was so heavy that there was about to be a revolt just before his death. One of the things that we learn is that Jeroboam recognized the load that the people were carrying. And Jeroboam said to the people, or said to Solomon, you need to back off a little bit. And that is part of why he ends up fleeing the country, because Solomon at that point in his life considers him to be a traitor. But after the death of Solomon, Rehoboam, this young son, takes the throne. And he immediately begins to get feedback from the elders, from those who were supporting Solomon, and their advice, their counsel is, you need to leave the burden of the taxes off the people. And you have that in the 12th chapter, in the 7th verse and following. But he rejects that counsel. And right on the heels of these older, wiser counselors come some of his peers, some of his contemporaries. And their advice, their counsel is, you need to tighten down just a little bit more. And Rehoboam comes out stronger than his father Solomon. And as a result, there is the rebellion and the kingdom splits right here at the beginning of the 12th chapter. So what starts out as a fine king, a man with a heart for God, a man whose desire is to follow the Lord and to have his wisdom and guidance and discernment, finds apparently that the success goes to his head, the pride comes in, and he begins to get his eyes off of the Lord and onto other things, and is described in the closing days of his life as a man with half of a heart for God, not fully devoted. Boy, I pray that that would not be said of us. That if our life were examined before the Lord, that it would not be said that we have just half of a heart for God, but that we're wholly devoted and committed to Him. He's got a tremendous work for all of us to do. And it's not building the temple, but it's building His kingdom. And He has drawn us together as a church family to do that. And I pray that we'll keep our eyes on Him. That it will be described of us as it is of David. That when it is said of others that their heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord, as was, and put your name in its place. I pray that that's true of us in the days that lie ahead of us as we serve the Lord together. And we remember the sad testimony of Solomon, who was, in spite of all of it, one of God's special people. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for the lessons that we learn from your special people. From Solomon, there are such valuable lessons to be learned. Father, cause us to remember that compromise is never the route to take when it comes to following you and serving you and our commitment to you. May our desire be to know and have the wisdom of God, to be those who exercise and demonstrate discernment and wisdom from on high. Father, guide us as we make decisions that affect the ministry of this church here. Lord, we commit ourselves to you that we would be found faithful, not in a half-hearted commitment, but as those who would possess the testimony of David as recorded in your word, we pray. In Jesus' name.